of what the two sessions on cultural diversity and corporate organizations will consist of. The first will be just a general overview of the situation, and with the emphasis on empathy.
Empathy.
And the second portion, which will be on Tuesday night, will focus on specific, hard, concrete strategies for making corrections or adjustments to corporate organizations, if they're required. So that's the way. Now, as far as the guidelines for the group, we will. It's very open, very participative, and also, if there's any questions, please, let's talk. Okay, let me just tell you just a little bit about who I am and what I've been doing now for the last 12 years. I'm currently with a large food retail firm. The company is Safeway Foods. I've been there for 4 years. I'm project manager there. I've also served as acting vice president. I'm in the field of telecommunications, so I deal with voice communications, video communications, voice, video, facsimile, and also to deal with terrestrial or satellite communications. I'm just going to give you a little bit with regards to the cultural diversity there, and just give you an idea, and then I'll go back. Within my group, within my organization, there's a total of 65 employees. Three of those who are black. One, which is Asian American. There's one director of the entire corporation who's woman. But I consider the corporation fair. And I'll go more into that. Why? And adjustments are there. Because I'm getting a feeling, I'm getting an understanding that they're making changes. Before that, I worked with a newspaper firm for about 4 years. And again, there were no people of color at all with regards to the director's boards. I worked with the San Francisco Chronicle and the Oakland Tribune. Before that, I was with GTE, New Media Services, and again, in the same kind of thing with regards to telecommunications. So what I'm going to do is now I'm going to open it up, and we're going to cover five areas. I want to cover five areas here. One, are they unfair practices, or are they unfair? You know, are the corporate practices unfair? What are some of the key reasons why people of color are not promoted in organizations? And then a touching on strategy, how body language is very, very important in this process. And finally, how to improve the chances of people of color and how it can benefit not only the organization, individually, how it can benefit. Okay, let's begin. How many people here work for companies, have been in the company, the corporate structures before? Have been or are currently today? Okay. Would you consider the companies that you've worked with as fair? That's a very general question.
I worked in banking for 12 years on a branch level, and it was remarkably unfair. Most of the tellers were minorities, Hispanic and African American, often single mothers who then were trapped because they had no way of getting education to move up into another position within the bank, or to get a job in a different industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the hours were long,
mm-hmm.
and the pay was awful. I can remember getting reviews where I was told I had done excellent work for a year, and they were going to give me a 50 cent an hour raise.
Okay. Excellent.
So.
Yeah. Any other comments?
Go ahead. I worked in the defense industry for a while, and there's some criteria they have to meet in terms of quotas. It was always interesting how they fulfilled the quota meeting and where the departments were that they fulfilled it. I worked in finance.
Mm-hmm.
There were about 150 people in finance, and you could start at the level of the first entry level clerk, and for the first four or so entry levels, you'd see a fair diversity. But as you got into the supervisors,
mm-hmm.
and the managers and on up, pretty much all white. But we also audited the entire plant, so I was throughout the entire plant. Some departments you would go to and you'd see enormous diversity. In fact, whites were the minority. And you could tell that they were making up a good share of their commitments plant-wide. And so, like on some of the lines, the different product lines, there'd be black supervisors and, you know, lots of minorities on the line mixed. And it was just such a difference between the finance department that I was in. It was mostly white. And, you know, some of the other departments, the clean rooms would be mostly white. But just, you know, there were pockets where, for some reason, white people prevailed.
Mm-hmm.
Data processing was another one.
Mm-hmm.
And other places, the lines and service, food service, things
yes.
like that, more heavy minority representation, even minority supervisors, but not the blend throughout the plant.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add before I finish, I had spent a year at Safeway while I was after graduating from seminary, and I worked in leases,
uh-huh.
Real estate leases,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty much a grunt in doing all the paperwork, but I interestingly got to read some of their old leases,
mm-hmm.
and I brought them down to some of the other people who worked with me, and I said, look at some of these old leases at Safeway, and where some of the criteria for the lease were, I used the moniker, people of color, were not allowed to be signers on the lease. You know, it just was
right.
all spelled out in the leases.
Was it written in the documents?
Oh, yes, it was written in the documents. And they're all probably still filed up there on the, whatever it was, the third or fourth floor.
Right, right.
The old leases at the mm-hmm. Safeway building. And they said, oh, yeah, that's old stuff. But I thought, well, just, you know, my eyes were like popping out of my head reading this stuff.
Yes.
How old is old stuff?
Yeah.
Oh.
Probably 60s?
Mm-hmm.
Previous to that.
And
earlier. So it was just incredible. And that was just, thought nothing, no one thought anything about that it was written in black and white.
Though. Yeah.
Interesting, black and white.
Yeah. yeah.
Can you remember also in Berkeley when we finished in seminary working for an engineering consulting firm, and the only person of color was the black guy who made sure that the executives' cars were washed. There were no engineers who were African. One, there was one African American engineer in that outfit.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh no, there were no women who were bosses there either.
Right, right.
Hopefully there's some parallels here. I work for a large educational institution, higher education. And the concern there is hiring minorities into faculty positions, particularly those positions that are tenured positions, as well as administrative positions. And
mm-hmm.
so, there are low-level faculty positions and there are higher-level faculty positions. I assume that that's somewhat a similar kind of
yes.
situation as an industry. I'm not prepared to talk about whether it's fair or not, except to look at the sheer numbers.
Okay.
And the higher the position, the fewer minorities.
Okay. Anything else?
I work for a company called Intel Corporation. I've been there for about 15 years, and I cannot say whether it is fair or unfair. There are things that the company does that, regardless of race, creed, color, ethnicity, are blatantly unfair. There are also things that they have done indicating that there is an awakening, that maybe all of these white engineers and executives could learn something, and they're starting to make some changes. And I've been concerned about that issue for a long, long time. And I was doing some stuff with a couple of my friends who are African-American. I said, I'm going to be leaving town. Can you take care of this for me? Because it's on a personal basis, throwing a computer together for a church in North Portland. And I said, and if you two guys leave to go back to school, you know, we'll need to hand that off to somebody else, but I want it to be somebody who's African-American, because I want that person to come into this drop-in center with the kids to show them the computer and to do the role modeling that's there. And I said, you know, things are changing, because now I don't know all of the African-Americans that work for Intel in Oregon. So, honest to God, it used to be that there were four, and I knew them all quite well, and we would get together and say, what can we do to change this? What can we do to change this? Mm-hmm. And over the years, we took the battering ram, and we beat on the wall, and we beat on the wall, and we beat on the wall, and the wall is starting to crumble. We've now got a man by the name of Ralph Gillespie, who's a notch below a vice president in the corporation, who's the highest ranking African-American in the corporation. And I was talking to one of the summer hires, and it was Johnny Belisere, going to Cornell on a 4-year ride from Intel. God bless him, African-American guy, he's doing really great. Mm-hmm. And Johnny was debating whether he should go on and get his PhD or not. So I talked to him like a Dutch uncle, and I said, go for it, but go talk to Ralph, because Ralph can help you and tell you things that I can't. And I ran into Ralph, and he and Johnny had already scheduled to get together. So, you know, occasionally you get somebody up there at a higher level who is interested in helping people. And whether they're African American, Native American, or white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male, interested in helping those people can do a lot for it. So I wanted him to get in touch with Ralph so that Ralph can help pull. But one of the realities is that we can all help pull people up and give them opportunities.
Okay.
So, is it fair? A little here, a little there, yes. Mostly everywhere, no, across the board. Mm-hmm.
Most companies, or I really should say all companies, are in for profit. Strictly profit. So the question is, how can the companies profit? So the best they're going to do that, the easiest way they can. I was in an interesting hiring situation. There was pressure from the outside to hire a person of color into this position that had opened up. And so the human resources department, they presented us with three candidates, and they were all three African-American candidates. Well, the manager that was sitting there, he right after the interview, he slapped his hands down on the desk, and he says, all these just are not going to work.
I'm not
going to
do?
Right. All these three.
They didn't have the body of experience?
That's right. Are not going to do. Now, there's... See, you can go in the other direction. You know, where you're presenting, where you're looking for an individual as opposed to looking for an individual that is, again, best qualified for that position. And again, that's highly subjective. But you can't. Do you see the situation? Do you see where what transpired?
Yeah, I'm on a board of the YWCA of Portland, and mm-hmm. we have an opening. Couple openings actually in our center that's located in the primarily minority community. And the desire was, became apparent, we hired a consultant who was an African American woman who helped to identify where our systems had failed. And so to redevelop those programs and to work towards hiring people that really have the management skills is what we needed. And of course, our hope was that we would have somebody from the community who have those skills. And we were hoping that we represent the diversity of the community. And in one of the positions, the family case manager, we were able to hire a woman of color. in the management position, it ended up going to a woman who worked in areas that were very related, but she was white. And we were, the consultant that we were working with did sit in on all the interviews and helped to establish the criteria, and she also felt that this woman was would be the best for the center. But there was that pang that we felt because we really wanted somebody, you know, within, and yet organizationally, we were at a place where we didn't have the, in a profit-making organization, non-profit organization, you have the values, but the difficulty is, of course, your ability to train people and help to bring them along, our desire to do that. But we needed somebody who didn't need that level of training to come into that position.
Okay, I see. So the next question then is, one of the things that I also want you to do as you leave this session at the end is something to take with you. You know, there was a, I don't know if you're familiar with the writings of Kurt Lewin. He was a person that applied mathematics to psychology and social groups. And what he, one of the outcomes of some of his writings and works is that it takes one person, takes one leader, one person to make that change. In other words, just not through necessarily words, but through actions. And eventually, the you know the others would, you know, follow. Because since there is so much diversity in our nation, we are communicating, although we're all communicating English, do you know what I mean? It's a different form. You know, it's not only verbally, but it's non-verbally too. And so, for example, if I communicate with you, then you'll be able to communicate with someone else in sort of a language that they understand, which would be, again, through the eyes and through the mannerisms. And then you pass that on. And if just one area changes, then overall, that's success. That's successful. Now, let's talk about empathy for just a moment. You need it. It's very important that you take yourself and you put yourself, again, in someone else's position. And always remember that by putting yourself in someone else's position. How would you feel if you were there? How would you feel? What kind of obstacles would you have to overcome? And as long as you keep that in mind, that's a very simple step that will then promote change. You also need to understand something else. How is it that I can benefit from having a relationship, a rapport with a person of color? How is it that I can benefit? And if you see that, also what will happen is there'll be they'll be attracted to that. And they'll see that, because again, you're talking, you know, the language. And you see the benefits. And then from that point on, you start seeing results. It's a very gradual process, but it's one that I feel strongly that will make an impact. You had a question?
I wanted to make a comment. Yesterday I was sitting out and reading, and I've overheard a conversation, and I do a lot of listening. I don't do it on purpose, it just kind of happens. I just tend to listen to what other people are saying. And I heard two physicians talking. I know that one person was a doctor, and I think the other was in a medical profession. I don't know if he was a physician or not, but the conversation would come around to getting more diversity of people of color into the medical profession. And he went on to say that, you know, we can't just walk out onto the street and just select anybody to apply for medical school. We need people who are more bright and so forth and so on. And I kept listening to this conversation, and I was trying to understand from his point of view, mm-hmm. about wanting people who are qualified, not just getting anyone. And my feeling was, as I heard this conversation, was, there's not that many qualified out there, and there's not that many that really want to pursue the medical profession, so why waste any time with it? And I listened to this conversation for about 5 minutes, and I wanted to jump up and go back there and say, I understand what you're saying about wanting qualified people, but what will you do if you come across somebody who is qualified and a person of color? What will you do then? And that's my question. Of course we all want qualified people, no matter what color. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a situation where you are in the power to make a decision, and one of those people are very qualified, matter of fact, maybe more qualified than the other, they happen to be a person of color, then what are you going to do? And it's a lot of attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I had an interesting experience on a helicopter ski trip, and we sit down at the dinner table like we do here and eat in that same fashion. And this gal that wasn't in our group applied to the Airway Express. What was the first one? 24-hour Express. Their headquarters is in Tennessee. And everything went to Tennessee, and then they fly to all points in the United States. So she applied for this job, and her name was Johnson. And they had a lot of Johnsons applying, and so they selected her. They got mixed up with the initials, the typist reversed the name or something. And so she reported for work, and their jaws dropped. They didn't hire her. But they couldn't deny her the job at that point. And she was laughing.
But going back to Eve's comment, I think it's not just a question of what do you do. When that person crosses your path, the question is, what will you do as an individual, as a caring individual of the society, to go out and help those people get to the point where they're then qualified? I was in a position at Intel a few years ago where I could influence the hiring of some summer students. So I went over to personnel, the person said, I'll take a six pack. At least three of those are going to be African Americans. Okay? Give me some resumes. And we selected this six pack of people and we brought them in. And by the end of the summer working with me, they had learned what work was. They had learned what the workplace was. And the African Americans, I made sure, were teamed up with other African Americans in the network that I have at Intel. And the Caucasians, I plugged them in with buddies that were around, easier to get to. And I feel really good now that two of them are still going to two of the African American kids are still going to complete their college education. One has dropped out, and I've lost track of her. But this one guy, I told him, Johnny, my goal, my vision, is that when you're 80 years old, you're standing up in front of this large group of people at your retirement. He said at 80. I said at 80, you'll work that long. And you say, and now one of the people that helped influence me is this guy by the name of Art Spurrell, and he's long since gone. But and that was my vision for John, and I think I'll make it. So I feel good that I helped give those kids a chance.
Yes, but you see, you didn't. One of the things that you teamed the African Americans mm-hmm. together, and you teamed all of the Caucasians together. Mm-hmm. And but what you really did, which is very important, is that you accepted, you took one underneath mm-hmm. your wing, mm-hmm. and then you communicated then with everyone else mm-hmm. for them, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all the time when a person of color communicates, it's all a part of establishing credibility. What credibility do they have? Do you see? You have to establish that credibility, and the only way you can do that is to work with someone that has that credibility to work with them, communicate, and say, well, this is what it is. This is the situation. You may not like to hear it, but this is the way it is, and understand it.
One of the things that happened to me recently was I was asked to work on the National Youth Gathering for the ELCA in mm-hmm. 94.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in charge of developing the liturgies for that gathering. And they said on my committee I should have diversity. But when I met with all the people who are in charge of the whole thing, there's not one person of color. I was sick. I'm sick.
Where is that centered out of?
Chicago. National Church.
I think the whole problem goes way back to childhood. Before I retired, I was a pre-medical advisor at, mm-hmm. at Portland State, and I taught the general chemistry course that pre-medical students take. And the problem is there are just very few students who have chosen pre-med, very, very few African-Americans.
Right.
In the general chemistry class, I would have maybe two students. In all the years that I advised pre-meds, I think I had maybe three or four African-Americans out of 200.
Okay, I want to continue to move on that point. What are some of the reasons do you think that's the case? Do you think it is because the African Americans did not recognize the opportunities?
Perhaps they didn't recognize the opportunities, or they weren't made aware of the opportunities that were available, or maybe it's just peer pressure or societal pressure that they just didn't aspire to that. I know when years ago when I was in high school and college, I never thought about medicine as a possible profession because I just thought it was economically unattainable. And I think that's the position that a lot of minority students are in now. Medical school is extremely expensive, and although there is financial aid available, not everybody wants to go $100,000 into debt on speculation.
Right.
What you're sort of describing, or hearing in several places, is almost a delivery system of mentors. Mm-hmm. Like you're a mentor at a certain level, and you've been a mentor. And I was just thinking, well, who was the mentor who didn't deliver the people to?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, where are we missing mentors in the system?
I think it's high school.
High school counselors.
Well.
It's lower. Junior high teachers, right. Elementary
even
teachers.
Even lower.
Preschool.
Look at the books that children, you know, my son, try to get him, now it's a lot more diverse. He's four. We make a big effort to get him books where there's people of color or women doing things that they, you know, 20 years ago there weren't even books like that.
Children's literature has changed a lot in the last 20 years, but society is still slow.
And Rush Limbaugh hates it.
Yes. You get it.
I'm a high school math teacher, and the problem comes way before high school. A lot of kids come into algebra, they have them go to college, they have all the right, they know what they want to do. But at that point, they don't have the study skills. Not just math, it's not that they don't know, it's only that they don't know enough math. That's part of it. They don't have study skills. They don't know how.
Okay.
I found a real disturbing situation teaching sixth grade this last year where I had two black students in my class, and one of them, The one girl was really sharp and she was really doing a great job and wonderful. And this other kid came into the class and he said, "You're not supposed to act like that. That's not the way blacks do it. You're supposed to be in mm-hmm. trouble all the time. You're not supposed to do it that way." And that was really upsetting to me. And it took mm-hmm. a lot of counseling with this girl to see that you know, she wasn't, she shouldn't listen to what he was trying to convey to her. And he was getting some counseling then to try to change his attitudes, that, you know, he really had a real negative attitude that I'm not supposed to do well. He was probably the brightest kid in the class.
Mm-hmm. But you saw that, and there was an action taken where...
They were both in counseling. Sixth graders are 11 and 12. Mm-hmm. So he had gotten that message early, and...
I think the parents are the most, probably the most important mentors. And I just read an obituary of a black woman in Seattle, right? And the story under extreme social economic odds, it told what happened, how she, her, and her siblings grew up. They all accomplished fantastic landmarks in their lives. And of course, we're really talking about the Western culture, which is competitive. And if you're going to excel in this type of milieu, why, it's going to have to start from the day you're born. And your personality is, and starts immediately. I had one acquaintance that says, by the time you're 4 years old, you know, it's all tied up into a package.
Yeah.
So, and so I think it starts at a very early stage, and probably at conception, and if you're spiritual, maybe before.
I would say that when you look at this situation, it can be overwhelming. You know, does it start in the womb? Does it start at one? Does it start at four? Does it start at 65? Does it start with the corporate America? Does it start with law enforcement? Does it start in the judiciary where the laws are interpreted in this land? And I submit that it is all of those things, but it's all connected. It's all that circle, and the question is, where are we on that circle? Now, what are we as individuals going to do to help make that get better?
Right, and it's one cross section. We have to look, take a small piece and see what we can do as far as the next.
Because the big thing is too big. It's too overwhelming. But what can I do with Johnny Bellazier? What can I do with Bill? What can I do with Mary to help them?
Absolutely, the ones that you come in contact with, the people that you come in contact with.
I think that's really true, and that's what, when I was doing this ELCA stuff and met all these people, and I was really mad that it was up to me and that I couldn't just do my white liberal shtick of being offended and sickened by how this is, but that I had an opportunity to make a difference. And it really was scary and overwhelming that I could say something. I mean, just as simple as saying, how come it's like this? And that with
that's not a very good thing to say.
That's threatening. That scares
the hell out,
especially corporate America. Why, it's always been this way.
Absolutely. And it's more so by your actions of what you do subtly.
And it's even worse in the church to say, why is it this way? Because we don't confess it that way on Sunday or Saturday.
Yes.
You're saying she shouldn't have asked that question?
No, I'm saying that the way that question is phrased, it can become very offensive. And immediately everyone, they put up these blocks.
Right.
And they're not going to listen.
Yeah.
Right. So it's phrasing it in such a way, communicating in such a way that it makes awareness.
Right.
You see.
Were you done?
I think that's very effective.
I have an experience which I still have not yet reached any conclusion with. I had some skills and background so that I could give some, I felt, mentoring, advice, mm-hmm. sharing very openly about some of the experiences I had to help a group of African-American women that had formed a nonprofit and were doing some organizational work, and their paper processes really were ahead of their own internal group processes. I'm trying to just do some sharing and be a resource. And I was very open that I came, you know, honoring that they had a good deal of experience that I could benefit from, mm-hmm. learn from.
There you go, yes.
And I was quite excited about the potential. I worked for 4 months or so, and I found as I looked back over, then I didn't hear anything, and I found as I looked back over all the experience that the body of what I was doing was always kind of at, to some level, my initiation and then their choice whether or not to accept. I had been invited to the initial meeting, and then they would say, when they'd set another meeting, I'd say, well, do you want me to come to that? So I always had given that mm-hmm. opportunity. And then there wasn't a meeting scheduled. They said, well, we'll schedule it. And then they said they'd call. Well, I don't know whether they said they'd call me, but I never heard. And there were a series of things that happened. And a lot of it was there where they were in their own process as an organization. And so I didn't hear for months. And there was part of me that, you know, took it kind of personally. Or what did I do wrong? How could, you know. And the other part of me of, well, this is where they are in their process. And anytime I'd have a personal encounter, it was always positive. That there was all the things that we would, that keep kind of the way we organize systems in our culture, you know, records of meetings, notification of meetings, communication, returning of phone calls, all those types of things, that didn't happen. And I began to wonder, was this a, you know, was there almost a difference in approach to that? And I knew that these women had real tight bonding with each other, and I guess I felt that, you know, I was not part of that bonding. And I always sort of felt that, though I was trying to be very open, that I felt that there was a degree of openness, but always to a point. You know, there was openness, but then there wasn't openness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is, you should, as far as it being expected to reciprocate with the trust, it's something that you might expect more than is there, but I think that it was effective.
Well, yeah, I just felt, and then I was just shocked because I attended this one meeting about 6 months yeah. later when they had some sort of a reception at the end of this kind of panel time. This one woman got up and said, well, there's somebody we'd really like to thank for all of this help, and then she named me, and I was just,
yes,
what?
Yes.
I've heard nothing for 6 months, nor yes. did I hear anything afterwards, though I, you know, said I'd still mm-hmm. be willing to help you.
Yeah.
Or confusing for me, you know, and not wanting to push and trust. I mean, I can't ask that somebody trust me if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
I can't ask somebody to, you know, allow me into processes that they don't want.
Right, right. You have to be asked, but you'll set up the situation in which we'll promote that to happen more and more. Let's move on here, and I want to talk just a little bit about strategy, very simple strategy. The first thing is that you respond, you don't react, which means that you think about it. Just don't get angry with the situation. Think of a strategy to get around it. If you approach it that way, and it's positioning areas, and just be aware of what's going on. Listen, hear, and that will begin to make changes as far as getting information, as far as reception. Always be positive. Although the unfairness is there, you see it. Again, anger is a good thing, but then it's to take that anger and then put it into some kind of action or strategy. And finally, having faith in God, that the unfairness that's there will be corrected. It will change. I have seen countless times when it has changed. You mentioned the contracts. It will change. It changes. The person that I mentioned who slapped his hand down on the desk and said, this is just not, and we went on and on and on, that has changed. He's no longer there in that position.
But he hasn't changed.
Yes. I'll tell you how he's changed. He said to me, you know, I went out the other night and I saw the movie about Malcolm X. And when I grew up, I always knew that I should just hate him or not like him for some reason or another. But when I got into, and I saw that movie, he said, now I know what it means to be treated unfairly. Hmm.
But to paraphrase Martin Luther King Jr., change will not roll in on the wheels of inevitability. It must be pushed and prodded, and that's our job.
That's correct. And it's, again, pushing, not...
It's not going to get over that hill in one shot. It's a long hill.
What'd you do about your hiring situation?
It turns out that no one was hired at all. That position was eliminated.
I was in a position where our group was downsizing and we had forecast the headcount to go down less and such, and an opportunity came up for me to move to another part of the company. So I did something very unmanagerially. I let my people vote on whether or not I would make my move, because one of the problems is deserting the people and having them feel left out. And 80% of the people that worked for me said, go for it. We did that by a blind vote. And then the person that I selected to replace me was the only African-American engineer in the group who had never had any supervision experience in the past, had essentially been held down by blind management. And people are like, why'd you select Jimmy Jackson? I said, because he can do the job really well. Just watch him. And I did some coaching on the side, and I was there to back him up even after I transitioned. And people were amazed at how good of a manager he is. I said, just give him a chance.
Give him a chance. Along with with regards to opportunity, it is very important that the opportunities be presented, right, to people of color, to women, minorities. And the opportunities presented may be impossible tasks to complete, but giving them that opportunity, not to succeed but to fail, is very important.
I think that's a real key point. Not only for people of color, but often women when they're in mm-hmm. positions. And that is that when they're put in a position, the amount of leniency, let's say, that a white man would be given in experience of failure as part of the learning curve, much greater, much shorter margin is given. Particularly, like, let's say, there's an example of women in clergy positions.
This happened in World War II, during the Depression, why, you know, not very many people were in a position of authority and leadership, because if nothing was going on. But as we developed this war machine, why, they took, there were so many opportunities for leadership mm-hmm. and getting the job done. Mm-hmm. And people apparently lived up to, they were appointed and apparently got the job done. You know, jobs that you just blow your mind, and they probably didn't know they could do either. But once given the opportunity, why, there were a lot of shining lights, whether it was on the front lines or up above, a lot of generals came out of that, and officers, and as well as what the family shows what, given the opportunity, how you can shine.
And I wanted to comment too, as I stated before, it all to me really boils down to attitude. And I just need to say that I sometimes have a problem with the word helping, because where are you coming from when you say helping African Americans as a Caucasian person? Sometimes I can see that as a condescension. Well, there's some feeling there, or some thought there, or an attitude that they're not quite capable enough to go after it themselves. They're not capable enough of finding a mentor themselves. Then I need to help that person. I really spend a lot of time looking at attitude and where a person is coming from. I wasn't raised to be a victim. I wasn't raised to feel that I couldn't do anything on my own. I wasn't raised to feel that I had to have somebody help me. Everything that I've done on my own, and by the grace of God. And so I never felt that I needed somebody to pull me up by my bootstraps. And I know that there's a lot of Black people who feel that they need somebody to help pull them up by their bootstraps. It's that victim role. And so, and I look at that too from a Black person's perspective, how they've been raised and what kind of signals and what kind of attitudes that they've been given as children, that you need somebody to help you. So I look at it from that side, and I also look at it from the other side. What does a white person mean when they say that they want to help someone, a person of color?
But there is a pitfall sometimes in trying to be too independent too, and being a lone wolf and not socializing, particularly in the corporate structure.
Sure, there's bad attitudes on both sides, and I'm just trying to speak to that.
But it is a problem to balance that. Mm-hmm.
See, my experience is everybody needs help. Nobody can make it alone. One of the people that helped me is my boss. His boss, the general manager, once said, "Art, you've got a lot of really unusual attributes that most managers would look at as problems. But Jerry, my boss, has figured out how to use those for the good of the organization. Hold on to his coattails." That's almost a direct quote. I'm not stupid. So I've stuck with him through thick and thin for like the last 5 or 6 years, because he helps me. And I came to a revelation about my career and how I measure my success recently, and that is the people that I help up. And who do I help up, and how well do I help them up, and how many. And it's not just African American. It's not just women. I've got a guy that I'm helping up now who's about 40 years old, and he's decided to go to law school. He's married. He's got 3 children. He's as lily white as I am. And I said, "Oh, you're going to be doing that? Great. Why don't you come over and work with me on these contract things and get some experience?" "Oh, you'll need a computer for class. Why don't you take one of these? It's a laptop. Nobody's using it." And it's helping him out with those things. It's helping him out by putting him in a position where he's working with some of our legal staff. And my intention behind helping this gentleman and the other people that I work with is the same, because nobody can make it alone.
We had an experience like that at the beginning of seminary, and I thought about it when you mentioned your 3 points earlier, especially about how God fits into this for us. We got together, and there's a group of people at seminaries who are, we're a very divergent group of people, and some of us thought, well, the seminary should be active and should be involved in issues. And so from the different seminaries in Berkeley, we got together and formed a group, and one of the first admonitions given to the group was that you need the group, that you shouldn't do justice issues alone. And I don't know, maybe Jim has experienced this. You've been very involved in Arizona and in many issues like this, but you need almost like a solidarity group around you, because you can end up getting, this happened a little bit to me in San Jose later, but you can be thrust onto a pedestal to where you really feel like you're there doing things alone after a while. Mm-hmm. And you're the only one speaking for this, and you know, you begin saying those things to yourself. You're the only one, where are these other people? And you really get so unbalanced because of that. And you lose the sense that God's presence, even, I think, becomes the voice crying in the wilderness. And so that sense of having a community about you throughout this, no matter what part of the process you're in, is very important. Whether you feel like you're someone who's mentoring or someone who's at some stage being victimized. I mean, even when you get to certain levels of height in all this, you can still feel victimized. Mm-hmm. And the community that you have around you, so that you aren't this lone wolf voice, is very critical. And we do tend to forget that. Everything in our society speaks otherwise, you know.
Well, I think you made a wonderful point early,
That's okay.
Early on about our society being very competitive and Western society, because that's not true of all cultures. And as a woman, as a clergy woman, there are many times when I'm thinking, who's going to rescue me? Who's going to make this all better? Who's going to help me? Who's going to fix it? And then feeling very resistant, I should be able to do this on my own. You know, I got myself through seminary and college. And I've received a lot of mixed messages about independence. And at 44, I'm just now starting to sort some of that out. Who am I, and what does it mean for me to act on my own out of integrity and a sense of responsibility? And I don't have a lot of role models for that. That aren't so radically independent that they're lone wolves, or so helplessly victimized, that really makes me just want to burst into tears. Because I'm trying to figure that out, and then to be responsible in my society, because there's an enormous amount of injustice, and yet not be overwhelmed with it and say, okay, what am I responsible for? Who can I speak for?
Right, taking a very small piece. Very small piece. Did you?
Oh, I was just, you were talking about help, and I feel there seems to be, I think the point about attitude is very important, because you can be helped in such a way where you're like, I can do this for you, and you can't do it on your own, or helped in a way in which, let me show you how, you know, mm-hmm. let me come along next to you. And it's very different. It is very different.
It is different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't trying to make anybody feel defensive, but I think it's real. I think it's a valid point.
I think so.
Because I've talked to different people, you know, about it.
It's can be a condescension.
Right. Very right. Condescension.
Well, a great concern I have is that for someone's individuality, when each person is so unique, and for a person of color to now then be perceived as a person of color. In other words, let's not see color. Let's see humanness. Let's see each. And yet, when one is a person of color, there's some unique experiences that you would have that would be out of the experiential realm that Euro-Americans would have.
Right.
When I look at Halpin, one of the things that I've learned from Eric, who has mental retardation, and the question is, how do you take the individual and structure them for success where they have the risk of failure? Now, I will put Eric in a position where he can suffer grave physical harm, but I'm not worried if he falls down and skins his knee. But how do I structure him for success?
I think
he's one of my teachers.
Yeah, and I think helping him just opening doors mm-hmm. for people.
Or saying there helping, is a door.
Yeah, or helping can mean erasing some of those old attitudes that you had. Like all Asians are bright and smart, and all Asians aren't bright and smart, and all Asians don't do well in math and chemistry, and all Blacks, you know,
don't have
aren't awful. Exactly. Yeah, the opposite of that. So I think helping to me means lifting and erasing those old attitudes and opening doors for allowing someone to see
that there is a door.
Mm-hmm. Right.
See, that's helping.
And even bigger, sometimes when we have power, we always think that, okay, we know how it's supposed to be done, and someone who's coming in is going to be taught by us how it's done. Instead of someone coming in, especially someone that thinks differently, maybe because of a different culture, might see another way for it to be done, and when can we change? In other words, can we be influenced by those beneath us in a structure so that we would do things differently, and that there isn't one right way, whether it's in Cal or the church, to do this? And that's where we really then stop treating people as victims or condescendingly, if we start being influenced and changed, who are in higher levels. People
about
us too.
Well, I was going to say also I was going to say also part of the helping is to not help to make it easy, you know. Mm-hmm. Help when they fall, help them up. Mm-hmm. You know, pick them up when they fail, because that will happen. That's the, really the only way anyone can really learn.
Through words of encouragement?
Yes, through words.
One of the things that has been real helpful for me the last few years, I haven't quite got it integrated personally, but is in the healing miracles, Jesus always said, well, what do you want? Jesus didn't step in and say, you need to walk, you need to see,
yes.
You need to get rid of your... He always said, right. Well, what do you want? And allow the people to articulate for themselves. And it seems to me that part of the healing was to be able to say out loud what it was you need. And who you are. I'm a blind person. I want to see. And then he saw. Wow.
It's a pretty radical idea to listen to the people themselves instead of to put your words in their mouth.
Which I think is what you talked about. That's that kind of condescending. Oh, I know what will fix you.
Mm-hmm. And that's where Respondo comes in. He didn't go out and look for things to fix. He responded. And he didn't go out to change the world, except in his own. But when there was a need, there was always a response. He didn't tell people what they needed.
I don't know if you, I'm sorry I was late.
It's okay.
Have you talked at all about something I've noticed, the sort of phenomenon that a person that ends up to be sort of a leader, and you were referring to that too, often in our society ends up getting isolated, and there are lots of ways to do it. Like with the whole civil rights movement, with Martin Luther King Jr. getting to be the only symbol, and then when he was gone, everybody was saying, well, the movement's over, and things like that. Or I think of people that also get isolated simply because they end up making a lot of money, like, and get isolated actually just from the very community that they're trying to work with and empower for themselves. I've seen that, and even you were referring to, I work a lot with Central American work in Phoenix, and other pastors would come up to me and say, well, Jim, I'm sure glad that you're working on that issue, you know. I don't have time. You know, and so if somebody ends up speaking out a lot, you know, people figure, well, that person is carrying the banner for us, and we don't need to learn about that, you know. I mean, how do you, I think community is the way that, but the sort of, Martin, maybe you have some ideas.
Well, yeah, just, it's all part of the communication, having them understand, you know, through things that you might say, to let them know, again, how is it that they can really benefit from cultural diversity? How is it that they can really benefit from working around a lot of people of all different, you know, nationalities? That, I think, is a simple step in order just to start the process.